well below historical highs, adding, in 2020, in sample cities, and homicide-to-homicide rate was 11.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. 25 years earlier, in 1995, the rate for the same sample was 19.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. The report states, and several of the starkest increases were reported in smaller cities with very small homicide counts, where even a few additional homicides can produce a large percentage change. The experts wrote, but the large increases in homicides were not limited to smaller cities. The report found that in Chicago, Illinois, there were 278 more murders in 2020, which equated to a 55% surge year over year, whilst in New York City's 131 added homicides accounted for a 43% surge compared to 2019 levels. The experts wrote, the three largest cities in our study, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, accounted for fully 40% of the 1,268 additional people killed in 2020. The report added, whilst there is variation among the cities, what is most notable is that homicide rose substantially in the vast majority of them.
Inside Israel.
Anti-Semitism has been widely used to slander all those who do not agree with Israel in whatever the case might be. But now, Israeli officials are being accused of anti-Semitism. New videos have been recently released by Israeli officials that actually mocks other Israelis and Jews in ways that can only be explained as anti-Semitic. The term has gained widespread popularity on an international level, mainly due to wide use, or some now say abuse, of the word by Israeli officials themselves to justify pretty much everything they do, from internal policy to external policy. But for Israeli officials, the term doesn't come any more handy than when others are criticizing them. When Israel is criticized, it automatically uses the anti-Semitic card to slander others. But what happens if the table is turned? We've all heard of Israeli officials and the regime in general call anyone that points to their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and their dysfunctional system as anti-Semitic. But activists from the non-for-profit U.S.-based Electronic Intifada online newspaper have found that the Israeli regime in its nature is actually anti-Semitic. According to the Electronic Intifada, Israel's new ambassador to the U.K. stereotyped a Jewish human rights group in anti-Semitic terms in a video she released as part of a campaign for a political party. In a Hebrew YouTube video, Israeli ambassador Zipi Hotoveli mocked breaking the silence as being motivated by money. The video depicts Jews as greedy. According to Jews Worldwide, and of course Israel, depictions of Jews as being greedy is a major theme in the history of anti-Semitic stereotypes. Breaking the Silence, by the way, is an Israeli NGO established in 2004 by veterans of the Israel military and aims to shed light on the cruelty of the Israeli occupation in occupied Palestinian territories. The video also targets Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem, calling them extreme left, and accuses them of receiving funding from the European Union and being agents of the EU. The video calls on the extreme right to attack these organizations so that their funding will cease to exist.
Anti-Semitism is basically a system that is designed to suppress all forms of criticism of Israel, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish politics, or should I say everything Jewish. Whether there is really hatred toward Jews for being Jews in the world, I actually hardly believe it. I think that a lot of people oppose Israel, and for a good reason, and it should be legitimate. A lot of people oppose some aspect of Jewish culture, aspect of Judaism, definitely aspect of Jewish politics, and all of that should be totally legitimized. As long as we don't hate people for being a people, I think that all criticism should be considered legitimate. I think that it is way more than Israel. The answer is obviously yes, but it's not just Israel. This is something that we see throughout the entire spectrum of Jewish politics, and it's not just Jewish politics. We can see that all over the world, politicians are using the weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to serve their own interests. We saw it in Britain in the case of Jeremy Corbyn. We saw it in the American election. Both sides accuse the other of anti-Semitism. And it's pretty, meaningless, because really you cannot find a single voice in the political arena, in the arts, in academia, who criticizes Jews for being Jews. Again, people criticize Jews legitimately for politics, for culture, for Israeli politics. You have to remind you that Israel calls itself the Jewish state and claims to represent world Jews. Whether it is true or not is another question.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic. Anak sarcastically says, people are calling Beteslim anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis. CEO of Corn says, but it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive.
Shameful what Israel has done, and the supporters of Israel have done, in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the State of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of anti-Semitism. Say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism, a very real danger, with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses. We dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who are we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotavelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achille Mbembe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The state of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, as same as you can say to other states. There, the state, the countries in the world, they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights. And you have to, if you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth. So maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semites. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and grieve and all these things. And if they are socialists, they say that they are communists, like it still used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros. He's an Hungarian from Hungary, a liberal Jew that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur Bet Eslam through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term, an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodor Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile toward Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish, but of course oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews, so it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not, at the moment, Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so, ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. Ultra-Orthodox Jews accuse the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Police officers were pelted with stones as they arrived at an independent Haredi school in Beit Shemesh that was opened despite the regime-mandated closure of all academic institutions during the current lockdown. Israel police said the volunteer fired into the air as he believed his life was in danger. There were no casualties in the incident, and police reinforcements were called to the scene. According to the police, as the police officer was trying to locate the director of the educational institution, a crowd began to gather around the volunteer who was standing next to their car and began hurling stones at him. The police officers left the scene without being able to have the school closed. The Jerusalem Post. The personal information of about 140,000 confirmed coronavirus patients in Israel was sent to the Shin Bet, Israel's security agency, without notifying them, in a clear and serious violation of several privacy laws. In a letter sent to Health Minister Yuli Edelstein on Friday, chairman of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, member of Knesset Zvi Hauser, Derech Eretz, referred to the unusual incident as a serious malfunction and said that it will have an unbearable negative effect on the public's trust in the regime. I-24 News. The United Arab Emirates has suspended the visa waiver agreement with Israel, initially set to come into effect in February until July 1, 2021, Israel's foreign ministry announced. Until July 2021, Israelis looking to travel to the UAE will have to obtain entry visas, unless notified otherwise. The same rules apply to Emiratis planning a trip to Israel. The decision followed complaints from health officials, while Israeli diplomats are said to have opposed it, wary of damaging the nascent formal ties between the two countries. The Times of Israel. A growing number of ultra-Orthodox Torah schools are reopening despite regime directives to remain shuttered as coronavirus infection rates remain at all-time highs, according to multiple reports. These join institutions of more extreme sects that have refused to close throughout the lockdown. The Haaretz report said the limited opening of more schools would likely have a domino effect and lead to more and more returning to studies in the coming days.
from me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is preparing to resume deportations of asylum seekers after a Trump-appointed Texas judge ruled against a 100-day suspension ordered by President Joe Biden. The ruling, in response to a challenge from a leading figure in the Republican effort to overturn the election result, marks the first shot in a legal rearguard action by Trump loyalists intended to stymie the Biden administration's agenda. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, U.S. to resume deporting asylum seekers after judge rejects Biden order. Stay with us for more of Julian Borger's article. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is preparing to resume deportations of asylum seekers after a Trump-appointed Texas judge ruled against a 100-day suspension ordered by President Joe Biden. The ruling, in response to a challenge from a leading figure in the Republican effort to overturn the election result, marks the first shot in a legal rearguard action by Trump loyalists intended to stymie the Biden administration's agenda. Human rights activists said the resumption of flights also raised the question of whether Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, who have been accused of systematic abuse of migrants and detainees, might seek to resist the new administration's efforts to reform the agency. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement plane left San Antonio, Texas for Port-au-Prince in Haiti on Monday morning, carrying Haitians detained on the U.S.-Mexican border and expelled under a highly controversial ICE interpretation of public health laws. Deportation flight to Haiti on the first day of the Black History Month, Guerlain Joseph, co-founder of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, wrote in a text to The Guardian, "What a slap in the face of the Haitian people." According to activists, there are also 23 Africans facing deportation from an Immigration and Customs Enforcement holding facility in Alexandria, Louisiana, as early as Tuesday, including 11 Angolans, 7 Cameroonians, 2 Congolese, and 3 others of unknown nationalities. Although the Haitian flight would probably have gone ahead even under the Biden moratorium, the expected African flight defies that order, as well as guidelines laid down by the acting Homeland Security Secretary, David Pekoska, that came into effect on Monday, 1st of February. Pekoska called the deportations to be limited to suspected terrorists, convicted felons deemed a threat to public security, and undocumented people caught on the border after 1st of November. At least some of the potential deportees have legal cases pending, and one of them was granted an emergency stay by an appeals court judge on Sunday evening. Others expected to be deported on Tuesday or Wednesday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement appears to be pushing ahead with the deportation flight despite reports that Cameroonians deported to their home country last October and November in the midst of a bloody civil conflict there had been imprisoned, beaten, gone into hiding, or in some cases simply disappeared. A lot of them were locked up in military prisons, which is where they took a whole bunch of people that are arrested by the army, said Mambo Tser, a Cameroonian community activist in the United States. Mambo Tser added, "It's not safe." Lauren Siebert, a Human Rights Watch researcher and advocate, said, "After scores of Cameroonians were denied asylum in the United States and deported in recent months, Human Rights Watch has documented multiple cases of deportees facing imprisonment, facing abuse, criminal prosecution, and threats by the Cameroonian authorities after their return. Some of their families have also been threatened and harassed." Taking office on 20th of January, the Biden administration ordered a 100-day halt to deportation flights, with certain limited exceptions, whilst Immigration and Customs Enforcement procedures were reviewed to enable focusing the department's resources where they are most needed. However, a federal judge in Texas, Drew Tipton, appointed by former President Donald Trump last June, ordered a stay, blocking the suspension but not the new guidelines. Drew Tipton's nomination was opposed by Democrats over concerns over his lack of judicial experience and his support for the reinstatement of a Texas social worker fired for using a racial slur against a black colleague. He argued, "It certainly does not evidence a pattern of hostility against anyone or any people who are of a particular race." The case against the moratorium was brought by the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, who played a leading role in the effort to overturn the November 2020 election result. Ken Paxton addressed Donald Trump's supporters in Washington on 6th of January, shortly before the storming of the Capitol building. "We will not quit fighting. We're Texans, we're Americans, and the fight will go on," he told the crowd, according to the Houston Chronicle. Ken Paxton has been indicted for securities fraud allegedly committed before he took office. He has also been accused of abuse of office by 7 whistleblowers and is being sued for retaliation after having the whistleblowers fired. He is reported to be under FBI investigation for the abuse of office allegations. Ken Paxton's lawyer, Philip Hilder, declined to comment on reports of an FBI investigation of Ken Paxton. After Judge Drew Tipton ruling on deportations, Paxton declared victory on his official Twitter account. "Texas is the first state in the nation to bring a lawsuit against the Biden administration," he wrote, "and we won." Echoing the language widely used to denounce the ransacking of the Capitol, Ken Paxton described the 100-day deportations moratorium as a seditious left-wing insurrection, which he had stopped. In a statement to The Guardian on Monday, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesperson said the agency is in compliance with the temporary restraining order issued by the Texas court. Justice Department lawyers argued against the stay in Tipton's court. The Southern District of Texas, but it was unclear when or whether they would appeal against the court ruling. a department spokesperson declined to comment. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, is seeking to challenge the Texan ruling on behalf of immigrant rights groups. There's a legal aspect to it, and there's a practical aspect, Cody Whoopsie, an American Civil Liberties Union attorney, said. Our individual Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers who may disagree with the new policies of the new administration going to carry out those policies, or are they going to attempt to carry out a more unforgiving immigration policy that they might prefer?
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone from the British capital, and we begin with our top story. Iran has called on the European Union to mediate a synchronized return of both Washington and Tehran to the 2015 nuclear deal. The latest call comes against the backdrop of crippling Trump-era sanctions against the Islamic Republic, the assassination of its top general, and continued American arms sales to Iran adversaries in the Persian Gulf. Saeed Poreza brings us up to speed.
It's been described as a Mexican standoff, with either side waiting for the other to blink first.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same thing.
We acted in strict accordance with the nuclear agreement. Now the United States needs to come back into compliance, and Iran will be ready immediately.
But let's see who did what and when. Broadly, in May 2018, former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the nuclear deal and launched what came to be known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign on Iran. A year later, and in the absence of substantive action on the part of the European signatories to the agreement, Tehran started reducing its commitments to the accord. Given everything that happened between the two countries in 4 years of Trump, is the deal still worth the paper it's written on?
The fact of the matter is that that deal has not been honored, and if it continues not honoring the same deal, then really that deal is dead.
And Iran has offered a solution to the impasse. Get the Europeans involved. The man to get things running, EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. But the Americans aren't only seeking Iran's return to full compliance. President Biden has spoken of follow-on negotiations, of a longer and stronger deal. Would Tehran take it?
Really, there is no goodwill between Iran and United States. So there is no way that you could actually extend your negotiation when you haven't honored what you have already agreed.
Iran's foreign minister has warned that the U.S. does not have unlimited time to return to the deal. And he is right. The Islamic Republic is holding presidential elections in June when power could change hands.
You know, it doesn't matter who is in power in Iran. Ordinary Iranians' experience of United States, be it at the time of Mossadegh or later on, and indeed Trumpism, has been very negative. They can't trust United States. And it is to this new administration to build that trust.
Not only that, Tehran is demanding the U.S. make up for its wrongdoings and to put an end to multi-billion-dollar weapons sales to Persian Gulf dictatorships.
The path forward seems to be clear. The ball is in the court of the Biden administration to give diplomacy a second chance. And Europe can make sure diplomacy prevails. Saeed Pariza, London.
And Homer Lesgave joining us from Vienna. Homer, good to see you as always. Now, we heard there from the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, hinting that perhaps the EU could play mediator here. What are your thoughts?
Yes, Amina, hello. Well, I'd just like to make it clear that the European Union has had a very central coordinating role since the JCPOA was actually signed and came into effect and implemented. It was envisaged as part of the text of the JCPOA that there would be joint commissions regularly being held, and most of the time they've been held here in Vienna, and that the EU will be part of that joint commission as coordinator, coordinating basically the Iranian side and the positions that are expressed by the Iranian side and the other parties to the deal, the United States when it was still part of the nuclear deal, and the three European signatories plus Russia and China. So that's the role that the EU has had in the joint commission sessions that we've been having here regularly. And now the fact that Foreign Minister Javad Zarif says that this is a time when the EU foreign policy chief, the lead EU coordinator, can act to basically help the two sides, as you call it, overcome this impasse. I think it is being seen as a step by Iran that shows that Iran does have the political will to get these issues resolved and to basically revive the JCPOA. Iran's UN ambassador, Majid Takht Ravanchi, recently wrote in the New York Times in a piece, we know that Mr. Ravanchi was one of the main architects and negotiators of the deal. He said that basically, if the Biden administration does not lift the sanctions swiftly, then this will show the Iranians that there is no sincerity, and that the Iranian officials have said time and again that the window of opportunity is limited. We know that there is a deadline now that's been put forward by the parliament in Iran, the 21st of February. The mission now is what's going to happen from this stage up to that 21st of February date. Some analysts are suggesting that maybe the Biden administration, for instance, could use an executive order to revoke the withdrawal that President Trump signed, and then task the Treasury with reviewing the sanctions issue without, for instance, immediately lifting it. Now, this is just some scenario that's being viewed, and they see that they believe that, for instance, if the Biden administration takes this approach, maybe Iran would take a next confidence-building approach, and something could work out. But this does need coordination, something that Iran says the EU can do.
On a final note here, Homa, there is internal and external opposition to this deal going ahead. What basically could cause it to be diplomatically dead and buried, the point of no return?
Well, let's just look at the fact that the Biden administration has appointed as its Iran special envoy, Mr. Mali, who was one of the chief and lead negotiators in the deal. And this has been seen by analysts as a sign that the Biden administration does have basically the political will to keep this deal alive. A lot depends now on what the U.S. administration is going to do. Of course, Ms. Biden has said that he plans to come back into the deal, you know, and to lift the sanctions. But now it's the game, as some analysts are putting it, of the who goes first. The important thing is that the whole analysis that I've been reading about is that because the political will apparently is there, this is not an obstacle and it can be overcome. But there are, of course, as you said, opponents. There are people who were critical of the fact that Robert Malley was put in this position exactly because they do not want a deal at all. Not just a better deal, but no deal at all.
Indeed. I will continue to watch this space. Homa, thank you, as always. Now we move to some other news, because Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny was in court earlier on charges of violating his probation and charges that could have him sent back to prison for 3.5 years. The 44-year-old Kremlin critic was arrested on the 17th of January on arrival from Germany, where he'd spent 5 months recovering from an alleged nerve agent poisoning. Now, Navalny left hospital back in September but remained in Germany for 3 additional months and failed to check in with Russian authorities, thus violating his probation conditions. Those were set back in 2014 from a money laundering conviction. Navalny's detention has triggered protests across Russia over the past 2 weeks. And with me for further analysis here is the political commentator, Jyoti Brah. Jyoti, good to see you. Navalny, some would say, sees himself as something of a Russian revolutionary. His critics might disagree, perhaps seeing him closer to a Western-funded puppet encouraging social unrest. Where's the truth as far as you're concerned?
I mean, I think objectively the truth has to be, with the latter description, he's absolutely a pawn of the West. In the way that he's portrayed, the West distorts absolutely every aspect of Alexei Navalny. They distort his prominence. He's really a fringe figure in Russian politics. They distort the size of his following, which is actually very small. They distort his politics. They present him as a kind of a liberal hero, when the reality is he is bordering on fascistic, nationalist, white supremacist. And they distort the threat level that he poses to Vladimir Putin, which in reality is negligible, whereas the Financial Times today described him as Vladimir Putin's most prominent critic. Well, he might be prominent in Western newspapers, but in Russia, that's really not the case.
So what's next for him? Because, of course, we're carefully watching the case back in Moscow here. We saw today he gave a rather rambling speech to the judge. They've retired for the moment to consider what happens next. In your views, what's the next step for Mr. Navalny?
Well, I wouldn't like to second-guess the Russian justice system or the Russian political system. I think the political mood in Russia is not in favour of Mr. Navalny, but it's clear he has a huge amount of backing from the West, and that can't be ignored. We could very well be looking at a kind of rerun of the Venezuela situation, where Juan Guaido was plucked as the favourite of the imperialist world to try to use as a figurehead and a spearhead to create a movement behind him to disrupt a state that was being run by people who they feel are hostile to their interests. So it's clear that's how they want to use Mr. Navalny. If they're successful in that, I'm not convinced they will be, but certainly we haven't seen the end of them manoeuvring and trying to create at least the appearance of some kind of a movement to justify further aggressive moves on their part.
On a final note here, Russia has made its concerns clear about perhaps the role of some social media apps in helping to fuel some of these pro-Navalny protests. Very briefly, your thoughts on how they seem to stir the pot, yet still be financial situations that are not supposed to be political.
Well, we've seen time and again in recent years, haven't we, the fact that the social media platforms are big monopoly corporations, very much invested in the US imperialist project. And again we see manipulations as well as outright censorship to make sure that the messages that US imperialism wants to be promoted get promoted, and messages that are counter to their agenda are crushed. So it's par for the course, I'm afraid.
All right, par for the course indeed. Jyoti Brah, thank you. Now we move across to Russia, because the country's foreign minister has denounced the military coup taking place in Myanmar, urging the military to return to democratic norms and release political prisoners. The coup has led to the arrest of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, President Win Myint, and other senior figures from the governing party. The military takeover began in the early hours of Monday, on the day that parliament was set to swear in new members. This after the military accused Ms. Suu Kyi's party of electoral fraud. The UK, the USA, and the European Union have all condemned the detention of Myanmar prisoners and echoed the growing international call for return to the democratic process.
This is European News Bulletin, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Well, we cross, unfortunately, Richard Sudan, back to the United States here, where there's been some sobering news And I think you don't have to be political here. You might have to be a parent, a sister, a brother, to really take some discomfort and some heart in what you're about to share with us.
Exactly, just some basic human empathy, really. A video has gone viral of a 9-year-old black child, a girl, being assaulted by police in the US in Rochester.
I counted at least 5 police officers there, Richard.
Precisely, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, Amina. Let's just call it what it looks like. This was the assault by a group of white men on a black child. And, you know, I think the reality is we all know that if we were talking about a 9-year-old white child from, say, Beverly Hills, you and I, Amina, would simply not be having this conversation. But the reality is the US police are completely corrupted by white supremacists. You cannot appeal to any sense of morality with these people because they have no sense of morality. They need to be incentivized to stop what they're doing, but there is no incentive because the police operate within a bubble of impunity. They are barely punished. Would anyone be talking about the police even taking action, Amina, were it not for this video? You know, many people really believe the police are simply not fit for purpose in the United States. And this is yet another stark reminder that we're not just talking about black adults here. We're talking about a black child. For many, being black in America is a crime in itself. And of course, we learn that from the horrendous murder of Trayvon Martin by a white supremacist a few years ago. Trayvon Martin was 17 years old. He was also a black child. And I'm afraid, you know, we simply see more and more of these incidents, and nothing but serious action is really going to stop these incidents from occurring, and certainly not the rhetoric from President Biden, who many would argue has made a career of pushing through anti-black policies in the US.
And of course, before I let you get into the brief social media outpouring here, the police chief of the union in Rochester has come out to defend his officers, saying they acted within the bounds of the law. I can't see how that you could have looked at that objectively and come to that conclusion. Perhaps social media disagrees with his analysis, Richard.
They certainly do. So Derelict Bird says, it doesn't matter how police bootlickers try to explain this. Pepper spraying a handcuffed 9-year-old girl is torture. And Justice Wisdom for Peace says, what is wrong with American cops? Pepper spray a 9-year-old black girl in handcuffs, but join and take selfies with white supremacists who storm the Capitol to take over. So many people are going to be keeping an eye on this issue here, Amina, but unfortunately we are seeing more and more of these incidents occur, and I think they're possibly going to get ramped up if no action is taken.
All right, Richard, obviously a young woman forever traumatized. All right, we go back to the UK now because the country's health secretary, Matt Hancock, well, he's announced 105 cases of the new variant of coronavirus first identified in South Africa. He's saying they've been discovered in the UK, with 11 of those cases having no links to international travel. Speaking at a Downing Street news conference, the health secretary said the government plans on conducting 80,000 tests in a handful of high-risk areas in an attempt to stop the spread of this new mutation. The UK currently has the 5th highest number of COVID cases, with over 3.84 million confirmed cases and over 107,000 deaths. French lawmakers have begun to tackle a new bill which they say will target their so-called definition of radical Islam. The controversial Macron-backed bill proposes over 1,700 amendments, including the close monitoring of mosques and the creation of an imam charter. This sets out a list of Republican values Muslim leaders must adhere to. The news comes weeks after 36 NGOs from 13 different countries submitted a formal letter of complaint to the UN demanding immediate legal action against France over its violation and treatment of Muslim citizens' rights. Robert Inlakesh, could it be that the world is taking a new humanitarian approach to the situation in Yemen?
Well, it seems that it is being portrayed that way. We pulled up a headline here which reads, Saudi human rights under new spotlight in Biden era. And this seems to be what is being presented throughout the press, that Biden's administration is one that is going to take a stance against human rights violations by Saudi, but that doesn't exactly seem to be what he's doing. He has frozen weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and also the United Arab Emirates, but many are saying this is just the normal process, and Joe Biden can essentially leverage what he would like to get out of Saudi Arabia during this time which the contracts are froze. And so when we're looking at this issue, it might not be that Joe Biden is particularly concerned with Yemen. He hasn't yet reversed the designation of Ansar Allah or the Houthis as a terrorist organization, which is essentially blocking aid from going inside of Yemen, the number one humanitarian catastrophe on the planet at this moment, as per the United Nations. They're the ones that declared it as such. But what we're seeing is instead is that there is this pressuring of Saudi Arabia perhaps to normalize ties with Israel, and that's why we're seeing such a spotlight being shined on the Saudis now. I would argue it's nothing to do with their human rights violations. There's been very little talk of the human rights violations, but a lot of pressure seems to be applied on them. So it's a bit of a leap of the imagination to believe that suddenly they care about human rights when under the Obama administration, where Joe Biden was vice president, they're the ones that essentially started and backed this war.
Indeed. The social media reaction with the backdrop here that perhaps Biden's just a smoother operator trying to negotiate a little bit more out of the deal. What's social media saying?
The first comment we've got here reads, after 100,000 deaths in the war in Yemen, Italy finally stops the sale of 12,700 bombs to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, just like Biden's move too late. And we've got, and then they say at the end there, but at least Italy will actually go ahead with it. And then we've got another one here by a user called Mason who says, it's all a lie about the arms freeze. It's just procedural. The media are making too much out of this.
Well, we're at least casting a critical gaze there, Robert. The next story, this is an interesting one. Perhaps for a country with such a large percentage of Muslim population, perhaps Kosovo normalizing ties with the occupation force in Tel Aviv was not something we thought we'd be seeing so swiftly here.
Yes, it's something that's came a little bit out of the blue, but it indicates many different things here. We do know that Kosovo has had these connections with Israel for some years, like the United Arab Emirates did, but it's a smaller player on the grand scheme of things here. But of course, this has been seen as an insult to many Muslims around the world, the fact that it's yet again another country with many Muslims who reside inside of it are normalizing ties with Israel. There were those connections made as well last year as well, so this is not completely without precedent here. However, what this does indicate, and I think this is the context, the wider context in which it should be viewed as, is that the Biden administration has paved the way for more of this to happen, and he's vowed, and so has Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, that they are going to go ahead and try and get more countries to normalize ties with Israel. But there has been some pushback. Reportedly, the EU today has threatened Kosovo if it wants to move its embassy to Jerusalem instead of Tel Aviv. So Jerusalem al-Quds, if it's moved there, there may be some backlash.
But what's in this for Kosovo? Are praise from the Americans? Because this was a deal brokered by President Trump.
Yes, exactly. And so when we're looking at this here, and again, this is something that's been carried on through the Biden administration here, it does look like Kosovo, like others, will probably have some small minor gains here, but a lot of bullying goes on. So, for instance, the United States can use its leverage in order to get small countries to normalize ties with Israel, and countries which are not so much economically dependent, like we've seen in the case of Sudan as well. That's the way they sort of blackmail them there. And so United States pressure wins out at the end of the day.
Unfortunately. And what are some of the viewers saying online?
The first comment we've got here reads, normalization with the Israeli apartheid regime has only one explanation, which is theft of more and more Palestinian lands. Kosovo wants to prove its existence through an apartheid regime, that's Israel. And then the next one here we've got says, well, isn't it great to see Biden doing exactly the same as what Trump did? Proves that the U.S. doesn't change through elections.
Wise words, softly spoken. Thank you, Robert Inlakesh. And that's where we leave you. Until next time.